Okay, Rohan. We're started. We're in Parak Bet. We were talking about Mordechai. I want to make a quick comment that I discovered after last week, even though we had talked about it before. Maybe it was before last week, actually. We were talking about Vashti, and way back at the very beginning, we talked about how Ahasuerus had stopped the building of the Beis HaMikdash. And I found a midrash in Esther Rabbah that said that actually Vashti had convinced Ahasuerus to stop the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Koresh had started it before him, and then Ahasuerus had stopped, and it was actually Vashti's influence, which really kind of makes the picture, you know, come around and fill out understanding of the celebration and the parties and who was celebrating what and why Vashti deserved to be killed, and it kind of really helps things make sense. So I just thought it was a really interesting midrash I wanted to share, even though it's not what we're up to today. Now getting up to, we're in Perek Bet, and we're going to pick up where we left off, just a little bit more to say about Mordechai. First of all, we talked about his ancestry, right? Mordechai, Ben Yair, Ben Shimi, Ben Kish, and who were these people? Maybe there were specific individuals. So the commentary in Megillat Sarim that we've quoted in the past says something interesting. I actually put this in last week's source sheet, so we won't do it inside this time, but if you want to look at it, you can look at it from last week, where he says that, similarly to what we've discussed, that really his ancestry is mentioned, these people are mentioned for specific reasons. He specifies Shimi also as Shimi ben Geira. We talked about that story with David HaMelech. And he says, Dafka, Shimi ben Geira was spared. David HaMelech could have had him killed. And Hashem arranged things in sync with David's. It doesn't sound like David did on purpose, according to this commentary. But Hashem's plan worked things out. Dafka to spare Shimi ben Geira because Mordechai was going to come out of him. Not just that he was mentioned, but actually it was b'kavana that he was spared, and in fact, David HaMelech's officers really wanted to have him killed, and Hashem said, no, we're not going to make the history work out that way. It's Megillat Sarim. So history's not going to work out that way. Dafka, he's going to survive because he will one day have a descendant named Mordechai, and who needs to survive. And he also mentions Kish. He says, according to him, Kish was Shaul. Shaul's father's name is Kish. Shaul ben Kish, but it's not so polite to mention Shaul by name, because why? Why is he mentioning Kish here? Because the only reason there was a Haman for Mordechai to counter was Shaul's fault, was because Shaul let a little vestige of Amalek survive, and so he is, this whole story and Mordechai's role is an outcome of the one who is the son of Kish, but we won't mention Shaul because it's not nice, it's not kavod, because Shaul is a really good king in general, but in this particular instance, this is the way things played out. So that was very interesting.
So Shimi ben Geira and Shaul were brothers?
So not brothers. It wasn't... Right, it's a good question. It sounds like it. The commentaries don't really agree on exactly what the relationship was. So I was like flipping through different sfarim, like, does someone have a family tree here? You know, exactly what the relationship was. Not so clear exactly. Not Shimi ben Geira wasn't. Maybe there was a different Shimi who was brothers with Shaul, possibly, but it doesn't... Shimi ben Geira wasn't... He was the son of Geira and Shaul. Shaul was the son of Kish, and Shimi was the son of Geira. So that wouldn't be the same person. But,
right.
But in other words, Mordechai wasn't descended from Shaul. It was his situation was descended from Shaul, you could say, because of Shaul's actions. So that's the guilt star on that point. Okay. Just to look at the pesukim, the pshat, for a second. Pasuk Hey, we said Ishi Yehudi Ayah B'Shushan Avira, Ushma Mordechai, Ben Yair, Ben Shimi, Ben Kish, Ishi Mini, Vav, Asher HaGlam Yerushalayim, Ima Gola, Asher HaGlata, Ima Chanya Melech Yehuda, Asher HaGlam Nebuchadnezzar Melech Bavel. Why are we talking about Bavel? All of a sudden we interrupt our beautiful laning of Megillah and say this in the tune of Eicha, which also brings associations not just of Mordechai, but of the thing that's being mentioned in the Pasuk, of Galus Bavel. Why are we bringing up Galus Bavel?
Well, it's explaining why Mordechai was in Persia altogether.
Why was anybody in Persia? It didn't say, you know, all the Yehudim who were invited to the party were Haglu Yerushalayim. Granted, this is the first individual Jew who's being singled out by name, but it seems like extra information. We've nitpicked about words previously. We're not going to nitpick every single pasuk, but this is kind of stands out, especially because the tune purposely makes it stand out.
Well, maybe he felt it. Maybe he was the one who experienced it, who felt it, who understood where he came from, and had a shifa to do something about it.
Okay, so what would relationship, what would be the function of that in, I guess, Esther in particular?
Well,
Why do we need to know that here, in this story? We'll point out that Golas Bavel happened right after and strongly connected to the Churban Beis HaMikdash. Have we mentioned the Churban Beis HaMikdash before?
Yes.
Yes, we have.
Uh-huh. Okay, so he understood the meaning of what was going on here. He got it.
Yeah, this was not incidental. The whole story is strongly tied to the Churban Beis HaMikdash and the subsequent Golas Bavel. And now this is this next step after that in Paros. You might think, whatever, Paros is like two steps away from the Churban, because it didn't happen right afterwards, so like it's a story that happened somewhere in the middle of Golas. No, no, this whole thing is attached. Churban Beis HaMikdash, Golas Bavel, Golas Paros Amadai. Purim story. It's all attached. And so Mordechai Shah suggests to us at the moment that perhaps he appreciated the severity of what the party was and what being under Ahasuerus' rule really meant for the Jewish people. Maybe some Jewish people was like far enough after the Churban and Bavel, that like they weren't thinking about that every day. They were thinking about like what's life like in Paros day to day, right? But he remembered it and he realized why it was such a big deal, and he functioned accordingly.
So he was like in the Beis HaMikdash already. I mean, beforehand, he was actually there.
See, he was exiled, which means just before the exile, he was there. What he do? I mean, he wasn't Kohen, so he didn't serve
him.
What
the loss was.
Right.
He understood the loss and he understood the meaning of what was going on around him relative to that loss, like how shocking it was, how awful it was.
I know you said the time, I'm confused. How many years after the Churban are we living right now?
Okay, so this is a good question. Remember, Ahasuerus thought the 70 years were up. So it wasn't actually 70 years from the time of the count of the actual Churban, but it was, what did we say, 67? We'll go back to our chart from the beginning. Mordechai wasn't a young man anymore,
right?
Right? It wasn't like eons. People were alive who had seen the Beis HaMikdash, including Mordechai. But it was a substantial amount of time.
Right. People lived, like the times that we live?
What was the lifespan? I don't know. Again, I don't claim to be a Bucky in history exactly at the time, but he was alive during that time, and it seems like there may have been other people. Well, there definitely were other people, because by Cheney, Chazal tell us that the old people who were alive to see Bayit Sheni cried because it wasn't the same as Bayit Rishon. So it was a thing. There definitely were people who lived into their 70s, 80s.
Well, they had to be like 90s.
Or 90s. Maybe they remembered as children. I don't know exactly, but yeah.
Since there weren't many that lived past 120.
Right. But people probably didn't live into their hundreds so often. I don't know. I'm guessing at the time. But again, it happened. Yes, there were definitely people who lived that long in this generation. Okay. The Gemara has something specific, though, to say about Hablam Yerushalayim, besides for our personal moment of impressions that we get from looking at it. So what does the Gemara say? This is on Daf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, the one that's labeled with a little number 2. Sorry if the page didn't come out in order in the WhatsApp. Okay, we have on the first column, towards the bottom, I put a little bracket there, Asher Hablam Yerushalayim, quotes our Pasuk.
Which section are we in of the...
Which page are we on? It says 13a2 at the top.
A2,
okay. Yeah. So it quotes our pasuk, Asher Haglam Yerushalayim, who was exiled from Yerushalayim. Amar Rabba Shegalam Me'atzmo. Rabba says he put himself into exile. He himself decided to go into exile. He wasn't necessarily forced at the particular time that he left to go. That's interesting.
Like
exactly. Awesome. Hmm. Okay. Perfect. Just like Yirmiyahu, and later on, some of the commentaries do compare him, some of the sub-commentaries in the Gemara actually compare him to Yirmiyahu for exactly that reason. For the Gemara and the Farshim don't exactly go into a lot of detail about why he didn't have to go into Golos. They talk about how the first stage of Golos was Golos Chereshim Hasgir, where the great Talmidei Chachamim went into Golos. I would have thought that Mordechai would have been one of those great Talmidei Chachamim, but according to the commentaries, he wasn't, but he chose to go at that stage with all the Talmidei Chachamim. And it was because he wasn't forced to yet, it was kind of a voluntary thing. And why would he do this? Okay, so maybe for the same reason as Yirmiyahu. Now, it's interesting because he wasn't really going with all the people if he went to that stage. He would have been going with the elite at that stage. There is a commentary, there's a Sefer Ein Yaakov, which pulls out all the Gadata out of the Gemara, and commentaries on that Sefer. So the Rif comments on Ein Yaakov that he actually wanted to follow Talmidei Chachamim Dafka because that's where Torah was going, that's where he was going. As soon as he saw all the Jewish leaders, all the Talmidei Chachamim leaving, the Gedolei Hador, he's like, I'm going to go that way. Like, what am I sticking around for? There's no Torah, there's no nothing. So it's almost, in a way, it's very different from Yirmiyahu, who was a people's person. He was there for the masses of Am, whereas Mordechai was more attracted to the Torah to follow them. But he still had a noble reason. This is said, the commentaries on the Gemara take this in a positive light, not in a negative light. Not that he was running away from the people, but the Maharal talks about this, I mentioned the Rif, that that he was, he's not criticized because he ran away from people, but rather he's praised because he followed Torah. So I guess for whatever reason, he didn't feel that it was his role to stay back. But the person that talk about this say, like, he was a person who loved Torah, who was so attached to it, that staying in Eretz Yisrael is a pretty big value. You don't just stop and leave Eretz Yisrael either. But he left specifically because he couldn't part from Torah greatness. There's one other commentary, I couldn't find the original, but in the art scroll on the bottom, thanks to Arthur for pulling together all random mafarshim, so we don't have to do the legwork ourselves, Tiferes Shlomo, is a commentary that says that he actually went for the sake of the people and Torah. And the reason he went down is, like in Mitzrayim, going down to Mitzrayim, he went down to prepare places of Torah for the people ahead of time. That he went because he saw this was the direction they were going, and he wanted to make sure they came to a place of Torah. So he went ahead and did that homework and set things up for them. This tells us Mordechai was a person of self-sacrifice and a person of Torah. Okay, and according to these commentaries, according to the Siddur Shlomo, also specifically for the people. Okay.
And he just continues to make sacrifices.
Yes. Yes.
It's like, if you want to get something done, give it to a busy
person. Uh-huh, okay. Yeah, he was the leader here, and we've talked about him with the cure aspect of things, definitely. Okay, I'm going to just put down a little bit of information about Mordechai so we can keep track. So we have Mordechai. Let's just put that. What do we remember from the other classes that we said about him?
From all the things. From Yemen, from
okay. What do we know about him personally in terms of his character or in his book? On one hand, he's a person of Yichus, maybe. But what his Yichus was really what? Maybe it was really mentioned because he made his own Yichus. Right? I'm going to write Shem Tov.
Yes.
That bespeaks this to me, that phrase. Okay? Shem Tov, he made his own good name. Right? We mentioned he had this kind of Kirov aspect to it. He was willing to be the chamberlain at the party for the sake of maybe some Jews of kosher. Right? We said here, he is an Oveg Torah, and he is Moser Nefesh.
And he also had, like, a bad name for some people.
Okay, so this is what's really interesting. I was thinking about that, and I was thinking how that may be part of his most sincere nefesh. He had a bad name, we said, all the way to the end of the Megillah, by some people, right? And yet it didn't make him stop, right? He kept on leading the people the way he knew was right to lead the people, even if people criticized him. Some, you know, leaders could be, we talked about, in tricky positions sometimes, but he was most nefesh, even if people didn't like him. Okay?
You could say about him that he was a leader, obviously, but you could also say about him that he had a lot of, he was a gibor, he had a lot of guts, he stood up to Haman, that was part of his leadership, but it was a leadership that took omens.
Okay, mm-hmm. Called guts.
So like, and like I would say, like, without any necessity of cover, without any necessity of anything, like even when people are bashing him, whatever, he got on just what he needed.
Right. Great Talmud Chachamim don't seek kavod, but some get kavod because of the way they are placed in society and in history and in, you know, the way life is for them in their context. He did not necessarily all the time. So he gets credit for that, and we can learn from him for sure from that. The Ben Yehoyada, who explains Midrashim in the Gemara of the Gadata, says that Dafka, because of this merit that he went down to Golus voluntarily because of his good values, for that reason he was Zocha to play a major role in what he calls the Geula. Not like the Geula of Shivat Zion aspect, but the Geula of saving of Am Yisrael from the situation. So he calls me the Kenegah, me the direct result of his putting himself out there to go down. Hashem made him the catalyst, one of the catalysts to help bring Am Yisrael up again.
Well, he's the linchpin, because if he hadn't had the interaction with Esther that he had, she would not, most likely, would not have done what she did. Okay, the Hatzalah would have come from somewhere else, but she wouldn't have taken the role unless prompted by
another. Right, so that's an interesting thing. We're going to talk about that a little more when we get to Esther. I'm going to add one more thing. We talked about one of the other explanations of Mordechai's name and lineage was that they all had to do with tefillah. And if you remember that, he knocked on the doors, you know, his tefillos weren't shini, weren't answered, were heard. So he seems to have a particular relationship with tefillah also.
What about that he said to come from Yehuda?
So that's something interesting also. The Maharal, I believe it is, points another thing about the Binyamin versus Yehuda, that he also is destined, he talks about like multi-generational things that were meant to be, where pieces fall into place and there's a certain tikkun going on. So the person, this Mordechai, who had one of the major roles as a catalyst for his Yeshua, had to be someone from both Mordechai and from both, sorry, Binyamin and Yehuda, because Binyamin was the son of Rachel. And Amalek came from, do we know where Amalek came from?
Amalek came from Lot's daughters?
Not Lot's daughters. Amalek came from Esav. Esav had a Esav's son Eliphaz, I think it was, had a Pelegish named Timnah. Not called Timnah. Mm-hmm. So Timnah was the mother of Amalek.
So why do we have a river named stream named Timnah?
There's Timnah Park in Yelah, I don't
know. Right. There's a whole area.
Yeah, so I don't know if there, maybe the Mamre Chazal about Timnah herself and then named after her, or maybe
well,
it's just,
kind of
I
don't know. No.
Not sure. Didn't research that one. I'm not familiar. Okay, so why am I saying this? Because Amalek came from Esav, okay, and the Chazal talk about how the person to counter Esav has to be from the children of Rachel specifically. And Binyamin was from Rachel, and Mordechai was from Binyamin. And Mordechai would have this leadership role where there wasn't a Jewish king in the time because Paros, the mother, was in charge. But the leadership, there's a concept of the Jewish leadership coming from Yehuda. And according to this, even though it wasn't true kingdom and kingship, he, as the function of a leader that he had, also needed to come from Yehuda to have that like relationship with the people.
Why would they give a reason why Rachel like this?
Why Rachel? So that's based in a different Gemara that talks about Rachel. I'm not going to get into that in detail. But it's kind of like a balancing of the scales over time. It's again, it's not one of these multi-generational things, but we're not going to get into so much specifically. Okay, so we have a lot of different things about Mordechai here. Now we're going to move forward in the shot. We talked about Mordechai. Now, what's his relationship to Esther? And let's talk about Esther. Pasuk Zayin. Vahi omein hadassahi Esther bat dodo. Ki ein la avvayim. Vanara yifat tovar v'tzavat mar'eh uvimot avi avima l'kacha Mordechai lo labat. He took care of Hadassah, who was Esther. Bat Dodo, I'm just going to point out, I always, like, pet peeve of mine, perm time, a lot of things that I think about from, like, the children's perspective, this perm is such a, like, ubiquitous holiday and story that everybody knows. Uncle Mordechai. They always call him Uncle, I don't know, I hear a lot of Uncle Mordechais. There's no Uncle Mordechai. Bat Dodo, straight in the shot, they were cousins. So I'm not sure where Uncle Mordechai comes from, but whatever. Just to clarify that little detail, but so Esther was the daughter of his uncle. They were first cousins. She was an orphan. She didn't have parents who were living. She was beautiful. When her parents died, Mordechai took her libat, which is maybe why people think uncle, because literally the pshat says like a daughter, which maybe sounds like a parent-child relationship, uncle-niece, care.
What? The British tendency to call older people aunt and uncle who are not related to, they're just older.
Okay, maybe that's why. That's interesting. Maybe they're British. Or have British habits. Okay, caretaker Mordechai. But actually, the Gemara tells us that's not really what it means. The Gemara, we have to skip a little bit. That's interesting. Talk to, yeah, that's interesting. Auntie, a little bit in English.
I love that.
So if you go to the next page, 13a3, just one little line here. There's a put a little bracket. It's like in the middle of the left side, left column. Uvimot aviyav ima lakacha Mordechai lo levat. That line that we just said. The Gemara says, Tana mishum avimeir al tivkri levat ela levayit. Don't say like a daughter, but like a house. And the Gemara says, like a household. And through Chazal, the term bayit also refers to a wife. So really, it's a subtle hint that they were married. It wasn't really a parent-child relationship. It was a husband-wife relationship. And the Mefarshim on the Gemara explained that it wasn't really a good idea for Esther Mordechai writing the Megillah to say it straight out, because Ahasuerus was still alive when he was already, and it would have looked so nice if, like, it said that she was married to Mordechai, and now Mordechai's in charge, and Ahasuerus and Esther are in, like, sticky relationships, you know. It's not such a good idea. So we'll say a Labat, because that will help the subsequent generations of Am Yisrael understand it properly. Okay.
But it sounds like he did that in order to adopt her, like,
Okay.
It was because she didn't have parents, so that wouldn't explain marrying her.
Well, it kind of gives a little bit of, I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence either that they chose the term Labat. I think it gives a little bit of a tone to the nature of the relationship. You know, husband and wife relationships in history weren't exactly the same as now, and there may have been a certain caretaker aspect to it, like he took her in type of thing.
Yes, in ancient times you could not protect someone who was your niece. You could protect someone who was your wife. That was the only way you could protect.
Or cousin. First cousin, even.
Right, a cousin or a niece. Or the only way you could really protect someone is if you were the father or the husband.
Yes, the pshat really does, the psukim make it sound like, you know, her parents died.
Because they had absolutely no rights. And their rights only came, I mean, until quite recently, their rights only came through their husbands. A single woman, and even in the 1800s, even until the early 1900s, mm-hmm. let's say in England, had absolutely no rights.
All possessions.
Or possessions. All her possessions went to her husband when she married him. He was responsible for her. And that was
and from father to husband, nothing.
Okay, yeah, so I don't think it's a coincidence. The psukim definitely say it right after they said she didn't have parents, and then she's going with Mordechai. There definitely was an aspect of the relationship that was him taking her in. And they were married. Okay, and so she was beautiful. I'll point out, not Stam, we mentioned how, like, Ahasuerus was who he was, and Hashem put him in the place where he was, so the story should play out with Hashgacha Pratis the way it needed to play out, or with options, you know, depending on how they shall behave. So also, Esther, I don't think this is also just shot the way it hits me. I don't think it's a coincidence that Hashem made the woman who was in this situation, in a specific story, who was supposed to become the queen and save Bnei Israel, was pretty. Well, Ahasuerus, if he was going to pick someone, he needed to pick someone pretty. Like, you know about Ahasuerus already. You know, I don't think that's Stam detail about her. I think it's a strategic Hashgacha detail about her. Okay? Okay. So, what's going on with... This is a little bit of introduction to Esther. We know she's Hadassah. We don't really know about her much. We know about her life circumstances, her name. So let's look in the Gemara for a second to find out a little bit more. Okay, we're going to go back to that first page that we looked at before, 13:8-2. Okay, we're in the top of the second column now. Vahi omenet Hadassah. He raised or took care of Hadassah, who is Esther. The Gemara says, Kari la Hadassah, the Kari la Esther. We know she's called both. So what is, you know, which one is she? Tanya, the Brisa says, Rabbi Meir Omer Esther Shema. Rabbi Meir says her real name was Esther. V'lamanikra Shema Hadassah, so why is she called Hadassah? In other words, if her real name was Esther, then the Megillah is calling her Hadassah for a reason, to tell us something. That's hinted to from the word Hadassah. So why? Al Shema Tzadikim Shenekru Hadassim. Because Tzadikim are called Hadassim. This is a righteous person term. V'chenu Omer Hu Omer Bein Hadassim. Quotes another Pasuk where it's used this way. Okay, then the Gemara goes on and says something different. Rabbi Huda Omer Hadassah Shema. Rabbi Huda says actually her real name was Hadassah. And Velo Minikriyat Shema Esther. So then if that's true, then why would she call Esther? Maybe we're supposed to learn something from the word Esther, not from the word Hadassah. Hashem Shaita Masteret Dvarim. Because she would hide her things, her information, her words. Shneimar Ein Esther Mageret Beramad. Because we know she didn't tell her background and her origins. So maybe she was a concealing type of person. Then the Gemara goes on. Rabbi Nechemiah Omer Hadassah Shemar. He says he takes the Hadassah side. V'lam Nekar Esther. Why Esther? Shahiyu Umura Olam Korinota Al Shum Estaher. Because Estaher is also a term for the moon. And the nation said she's as beautiful as the moon. Okay? Then Ben-Hazai says something else. Esther lo aruka v'lo k'tzara haita ela benoni kehadassah. Her real name was Esther. And she's called Hadassah because just like a myrtle branch is not too tall, and it's not too small, so also Esther was not too tall and not too short, she was just right.
Well, why couldn't it be both? Why couldn't it be the first and the second? Why do we need the third?
It could. But each one is adding something new, so they don't settle for the last one, even if they might agree with it. They're adding something new by introducing their own comments.
My mother's name, was in English, was Estella, okay, and in Hebrew was Hadassah. Instead of Her parents called her the Esther in English, because Esther and Estella are the same name. Estrella, Estella, Esther, they're all the same name, slightly different languages. And Hadassah was her Hebrew name. She used, you know, when she was here, she was known as Hadassah in America, not Estella.
Okay, so there you have it. Good. Okay, so this is another aspect of Hadassah. Now we're going to continue on the next page. One has a little 3, 1383. And there's even more to say about her name. There's a lot of ideas from her name. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Karach Amar, what does he say? Esther Yirak Roket Haita. V'chut shel chesed mashuch alaha. Esther was greenish, and presumably this is a explanation of the name Hadassah. She called Hadassah because
that's where the green comes from.
That's the green complexion thing. And however, just by the way, so you know, even though we just said that she had this kind of weird sounding greenish complexion, don't worry, Hashem made sure everybody liked her. She had this chesed chen about her that appealed to people. So that's kind of countering that point. Okay? So we have a bunch of information about Esther here, Esther/Hadassah. What do we write Esther on top because that's what y'all call her. But what do we know about her from this Gemara? What?
Pretty secretive, according to some, righteous, beautiful as the moon.
Okay, pretty, we said, is kind of a shkacha in the picture. Okay, we have.
I think what was pretty was that she had chayim, that kind of encapsulates no matter what color she was.
Okay.
Obviously, because it says that everybody found her, you know, was attracted to her. She was an attractive person.
Okay, I mean, I think there is, again, function to the actual physical prettiness. I think that has a function, but also it was not only that, it was more than that.
She's secretive, she's righteous.
Okay, secretive.
Not too short.
Okay, medium height. Isn't that funny? In the middle of her nice, you know, beautiful sounding midotes and character traits, she's a medium height, by the way.
It's so interesting. The green skin detail is like something that, like,
greenish.
I did not get it out of my head as a kid. Like, once someone told me she was green skin, I was like constantly like, people have green skin.
Now, like, if you want to put a nice name, like olive skin, olive complexion,
it
sounds
like what we call sallow or olive.
Right. So it's interesting because the Gra and others say that what's that about? It's praise of her. It's not just like her skin complexion. It's praise of her because she was kind of sickly because of what happened to her. That she was so traumatized. I couldn't find it. I always thought it was because, we didn't reach this Gemara yet, but because she didn't eat so much in the palace. We'll see what she ate or what she didn't eat, that it wasn't so much because she couldn't get kosher food, maybe, according to my opinion. And either it was because of her eating habits in the palace, or the Gra says because she was like traumatized, so she was just like nauseated by everything. So in other words, it's not just purely physical, but it's actually reflective of her inner perspective on the world and experience of the things that happened.
There was also another point that always hit me, like from a relatively young, how horrendous, wonderful over, and then she had to go on living with that.
Right, she really is a tragic character in a sense. There's definitely that aspect of Esther, which is not the primary one, but if you stop and think about it, you definitely realize that. Okay, we still didn't explain the medium height part.
Well, but I mean, it's not only tragic, but it's the same with Siris Nefesh as her uncle.
Interesting.
She does tremendous mysterious.
Interesting, okay. I'm going to tie it to the greenish just because that's what we're learning right now, but you're right, it lasts through the whole story, and after the story ended, she has the same mysterious nefesh. Interesting.
I mean, she goes through with this whole charade and attracts Achashverosh, which is obviously tremendous mysterious nefesh, especially if she's married to someone else. And then what she does in her moment of glory, of putting herself on the line, is also considered snappish because she could have been killed.
So she realized tremendous considered snappish.
So there she has this sort of peak, and then she continues for her, the rest of her life.
Yeah. I'm going to add orphan just because that's part of the details that we were told. Okay, so we're ready, you know, we can start thinking of that as. We can start thinking of them in the traditional, you know, we've been looking at things psychologically and historically, whatever. But like here, traditional Shir. These are our role models so far from the story, from what we know about them.
They both, you know,
they went through a lot and they put themselves in difficult places, and they're very passionate and steadfast in their beliefs and their leadership. 100%. Okay, I want to address this greenish medium height thing. Because those are the weird parts that we didn't really explain, right? And this is a little bit, I'll admit, is my own, I don't know, opinion, chiddush, perspective, take it or leave it, based on what I've learned. And I couldn't help it. It's based on my favorite topic in the world, which is color symbolism in the Torah. So look, there it is. She's Yirak Rokes. What's that supposed to mean? Okay, so for the Mahalich that I'm going to suggest, We're going to go back to a Kabbalistic approach, actually, because in the starting the Zohar and developed more from Moshe Cordovero, there's an idea that color, and even mentioned it in a sense previously, that colors in the Kabbalistic world are symbolic of the spheres, the different aspects of Hashem through which he interacts with this world, which are also aspects of human personality through which we express ourselves in this world. We mentioned it with regards to the multicolored nature of the party, and now we're going to talk about it in one specific color with one specific character in the story. Forgive me for calling Esther.
Can I say something that's just very mundane? I mean, it's interesting because green, when applied to skin, is a very negative, you think of sickly, you think of nauseous, you think of, you know, maybe you could think of olive skin, but green as a color in the world is the color of renewal and rebirth and nature and.
Interesting.
Kind of interesting.
So I'll, because you said that, I'll add in a different aspect, which I wasn't necessarily going to say, but you just got it included. The Ramosh Kodavar in particular highlights two different symbolisms of green. The one, which we're not going to spend as long talking about, which is related to what you said, is that green is the nature. And he actually talks about it as the color of fruit before it's ripe. Uh-huh. It's a color of foliage and growth,
right.
But it's also the pre-birth color.
I never thought of that.
Isn't that interesting? Okay, yeah, you have like vegetables that are green, but in general, things grow and they're not quite ready yet, right? It's almost like a hidden development.
Oranges.
Right.
Not every fruit, but.
Right, but it's a common identification. It's used to identify something that's not quite ripe yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in that sense, I think this story is the pre story to a Yeshua, to a birth, to a Geula story. And so, Esther's functioned in all of these stages before the Geula and the Yeshua. Yes, you know, when it happened, she was also the head with Mordechai, but her godless is in her role pre-birth, pre-Yeshua. So that's one aspect that I notice about it. The other aspect we're going to spend longer talking about is relating to the Spheros in particular. He relates that to the one of the upper Spheros, Bina, which is related to those themes. The one that actually is more common is in the Zohar itself and in different places is the sphere that's called Tiferet. It's symbolized by a rope. That there's white and there's red, symbolizing Chesed and Gvura. And then this middle Midah sphere, which is the balancing, harmonizing, blending middle ground of a sphere, it represents all those things, called Tiferet, is symbolized by a rope. Chesed is symbolized by white often. Gvura is often symbolized by red, and Sefer is often symbolized by Yarok, which is what she's called. Yarok greenish. The truth is, in Chazal, in the Mishnah, Yarok is a bit of machlokas. It may be green or maybe actually a yellowish color, if you follow the term in the Mishnah. So a yellow.
That would be sallow.
Okay, so that fits more with that term sallow. I'll look sallow. So something in that color group. And the thing about this Midah Tefer, if we're going to go with that symbolism of the color, is that it's a harmony color. It's a harmonizing, perfect balancing, not too much of one and not too much of the other. So when I thought of that, this is really the first thing that I thought of. I was like, oh,
not too tall,
and not too short, maybe physical or maybe symbolic, perhaps. And we're going to see this. I'm like presenting this whole thing today, but as we continue in Megillah after today, keep your eye out for this Midah in Esther and see when and how it plays out, because I believe that this is a strength of hers in the Megillah, and we're going to just go a little bit more about it now, where she is sometimes one way and sometimes the other way. She knows just how to balance them, just when to be like this and when to be like that. And I'm going to direct you to a Midrash that I sent you, which I love, just because it sounds... I like the wording of it. That's what I sent you inside. It's the one that's a different format of a page, Midrash Rabbah, with all the Hebrew on the top and all the Hebrew on the bottom. There are two pages I sent you from the Midrash, actually. It's the one... it says Kuf Ayin Vav at the top, in the top right corner, where it says, and in Hebrew, it's the second little paragraph. There's two lines underneath. Vahi Omeda Hadasa, Mahadasa, Rechama tok v'ta'ama mar, kein haita Esther mitu ka l'mordechai, umara l'haman. A hadas is, it has some things, in some areas it's rich, and in some areas it's poor, you could say, right?
But
it has a rich smell.
Nice, but it doesn't taste good.
Exactly. So too Esther was, she was rich in, not even rich, but she was sweet in some ways, and bitter in other ways. She was very sweet to Mordechai and very bitter to Haman. So I don't really think this is the way the Midrash means it, but when I read those words, the first thing I thought it was like a sweet, like a woman who's very sweet in her demeanor and like the way she talks, and she's such a sweet lady and whatever. And then there's like the bitter old lady who's, you know, Mara, who's cranky and rude and right? And again, I don't think this is really what the Midrash means, but she was sweet to Mordechai and bitter to Haman.
But I don't think that's, I wouldn't take it that way. I would take it more as if whatever her actions were, this is what they meant. These were actions that Mordechai favored. These were the actions that brought Haman down. They were the exact same things. It's just how did each of them experience it?
So I don't know that it's specifically referring to the same actions. In other words, she did something
It was the precursor to Haman's downfall.
So could be, but she also actively invited Haman to a party where she planned his downfall. In other words, and that was meaning, yes, Mordechai agreed and approved of it, but that wasn't an action addressed to Mordechai. That was an action addressed to Haman. Uh-huh. She dealt with him bitterly. She was strategic and conniving and, sneaky. It reminds me of Yaakov a little bit, in these parshas we're reading. With Haman, she was bitter. She was like, let's see what I can do. She was really figuring that out. And with Mordechai, this is the next point I want to point out in the Peshat, is if you look at the context with Mordechai, first it says how Mordechai related to her, but then, we can notice it as we go to the Pesukim, so it's not to jump too much, but you'll see, she basically does whatever Mordechai says. Mordechai says, she does. Jump up, she jumps, She was very sweet to him. She followed his instructions. He was the God of the Torah. He was the boss. He was the one who took her in.
Until the moment came, and then she said no. Okay.
Yes.
That's how she starts out.
Exactly. So she starts out. So this is going to tie into our Tiferet thing of the balance, where you already are seeing ahead of the Pesukim that we're not up to, but we know the story. Right. Once again, she's able to be complacent, complying, quiet, obedient when it's the right time, but she's also able to take charge and play an active role when it's the right time. So she has this meat in her. She's medium height. She's Yarak Roke. She's greenish, I'll just give it away. Why not? Since they're all on the board. Okay, secretive, right? She starts out not telling her background, and then just at the right moment at the party, bidyuk, when it's going to be the biggest punch, she lets it out. Right? She doesn't always stay secretive. She knows when to be this and when to be that. Okay?
Manipulative.
But she's not always manipulative. Not with Mordechai. She's sweet with Mordechai.
No, but in the secretive sense that you're talking about. I don't think
it's manipulative. Well, I think it's strategic.
So I'll tell you what. Let's look at the terminology.
That's kind of what I mean.
She has a plan,
and she's manipulating reality towards the outcome that she wants.
So I'm going to differ a little bit.
That's not a simple thing to plan, to figure out how to orchestrate. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to adjust that a little bit, though. If we look at the wording of the Pesukim, we see that that's not the case right now. Right now, yes, she's concealing her origins, but let's read the way the Megillah is telling us how that happened. Okay? So, we're in Paragvet Pasuk Chet. Okay? V'hi b'hi shama dvar ha-melech v'dato u'bi kaveitz na'arot rabot el shushan abirah al yad hegai v'atil akach Esther el beit ha-melech al yad hegai shomer anashim. So, here is it. First we introduce to the people Esther, this is Mordechai, this is Esther, this is their relationship. And now back to our story. When the king's word and his rule was heard, they gathered all the women into Shushan, and Haggai was the one who had this job of taking care of the women who came in. Vati lakach. Hebrew grammar. Who knows Hebrew grammar? Who took over? Okay, you can't always assume Hebrew grammar from Tanakh because it's different than modern Hebrew. But vati lakach means she was taken. Not v'hi halcha. Okay, but she was taken to the house of the Melech, to Haggai, who was in Shomer Anashim. Next pasuk, Vatita benara be'inav, Vatisachin lefanav. Not she ingratiated herself to them, not she did anything in particular, but she just was good in their eyes. She found favor in front of him. They liked her. That was just the way it was to them. Vayvahel et tamrukeah. So then when they saw it that way, when he saw it that way, Haggai, something about her resonated.
That was the chain, right?
So it's not only physical. There's a chain there that Haggai picked up on. He did something extra for her. So he quickened things for her. He was like, oh boy, this person's special. Let me get her makeup faster and her stuff different, and her maidservants to help her, just the right ones to help her. And she he changed things around, Beishamneha, that Naratai changed things for her and her helpers, Lato, for the better. He wanted her to have a little advantage.
Everything here is happening to her, she's not taking any action.
Right. That's exactly where I'm going with this. So she's not conniving anything right now. She's not being manipulative, she's just going along with it. She did, you know, she married Mordechai. It sounded like Mordechai was the more dominant, not in a bad way, in a good way, you know, member of the relationship. He took her in. Now they're taking her out. Haggai is taking his perspective on the whole thing. She's not really doing anything.
But do you think she's like, wow, this is really interesting. This is a lot of hashgacha prati. Do you think she, or it wasn't even that?
I don't see that.
But I would also see it as a continuation of what I said before about women and their place in non-Jewish society. This is the first time, this is where she acquires power. In other words, her attractiveness and ability to attract him and then the king afterwards, that is the source of her power.
Which is pain. And you
just
said that.
That's right.
I really just made note of that. I mean, do you see that that's the ikar of what we need to be as Jewish people and certainly as Jewish women? We need to be pleasing in the eyes of all around us, which is chayin. And that's
what she wants.
She didn't try, though. Here's the thing. She didn't try to do that.
But what is that?
In his
eyes. But it just was her.
Okay, so maybe she just exuded that.
I mean,
granted.
She is a Jewish.
Granted,
after
she
all,
maybe this was an inequality.
She started to understand the power of it.
Okay, so I'm just going to skip.
Maybe.
I'm going to skip a second. In the next page of the Gemara, 13a4, we do see that in the Gemara also, the second column at the top. Okay, it says, Vati Esther Nosechin, this term. We didn't get to that. What person is there?
I see it.
That's a little bit later. No. We could find the person.
Right.
No. Teva. Okay, Pasuk Teva. We didn't get to it yet. We're all talking about Chayin. The Pasuk didn't even say Chayin. Just a Pasuk. We're intuiting, us women over here, we're intuiting that when the Megillah says that she found favor in his eyes and he favored her, she must have had Chayin. It didn't say that yet. It says it in Pasuk Tevav, but the Gemara does comment on that Tevav that Amar Rabbi Elazar Melamed, what does this teach us? That the Megillah does say that word, we just didn't get to it before. Shelakol echad v'echad nidmita lo kumato. It wasn't just in Haggai's eyes that she found favor, but later when it's not talking about Haggai, it also uses the word Chayin, and that means that everybody not just liked her, but everyone kind of felt like she was of their own. They all felt, you know, they didn't know where she was from.
Was there a mention from everybody? That's like a very important thing. That's like
she was relatable. She was nice and,
because she was authentic to herself, which is what made her probably so great.
A new level, but this is a new level. As a member of the O Nation, they thought that she came, like when I meet in my community person and I know that her mantra's better,
right?
That's a whole new level, like that, right?
It's not just like we like her. It's like, she seems like one of us. And I might venture to say that perhaps that even is a little bit related to this Tiferet idea. Of Tiferet is balanced this way and that way. She could go this way, she could go that way. She was of this nature and of that nature. If these national, if you want to, you know, generalize cultures, if this culture is rough and tough, she seemed rough and tough to them. If this culture is gentle and calm, then she seemed calm to them. Whatever they were, she seemed like all the things. Because she had it all in her in some kind of balance.
She should have been.
She should have gone to what? Okay.
So very true.
She marketed Am Yisrael. She marketed Am Yisrael to Achashverosh.
I was thinking about it.
Okay, so that was just our little miniature jump ahead. But so let's keep reading, because let's figure out from the Pesukim again, is she really trying, granted, maybe she had this thing in her, but was she trying to do this? Was she already manipulating, or was that something that came later? So far we saw a little bit more of a passive terminology. Let's see, Pasuk Yud. Lohi Gida Esther Adama, that Malata. This was exactly what we're talking about, right? She didn't tell her nation or her birth source, her land of origin. Ki, why? Not because she was manipulating. Ki Mordechai Tziva Ola Asher Lo Tagi. Because Mordechai said so. Mm-hmm. So she did it. Mm-hmm. She listened. She was obedient. She knew who to listen to. Don't get me wrong, this is a good thing. She listened to God the Ador. She listened to Mordechai HaTzadik, right? Leader of the Jewish people, who's all these wonderful traits that we talked about. She knew who to listen to. But she listened. It wasn't her idea. It wasn't her plan. It wasn't her idea. This is what she did. Okay? And then Mordechai continued taking care of her in the next pasuk, the same way that he cared for her before when she was vulnerable. Continue. Now she's vulnerable in a different way. Ubechol yom bayom Mordechai mitalech lefnichatzer ben anashim ladat et shalom ester umayaseh ba. Maye aseh ba. What will be done with her. Not what she will do. Not what's going to happen, but what will be done to her. He's kind of, almost the assumption is, something's going to happen to her. This is just who she is. She's someone that things happen to. She goes along with things. She's vulnerable, perhaps.
Well, she was in the king's palace.
Okay, perhaps I said a little bit, you know, strongly.
There was a process, as we see, that every woman had to go through, and she had
no, she was genuinely vulnerable. It wasn't her fault. This is, again, this is, I'm going to suggest that this is her personality.
She,
everyone was Onis, for sure, and but the Megillah didn't have to say that. The Megillah could have said, what's going to happen next? Mordechai was checking. Or it could have said, you know, Mashloma, how's she doing? Maye aseh ba tells us something's going to happen to her. Vatilakach, right? Called because Kimorchai Tzivala. So far we're seeing again and again terminology in the Pshat that indicates that her nature, her style, her modus operandi was passive more. Okay? Submissive, perhaps. Okay? So I just wanted to point out that shop tendency we're seeing.
Maybe Mordechai understands already that she is to be the Kli.
Yeah, that's where I'm getting at. I feel like he recognizes she is like a, you know, an antenna in this whole circumstance, and he sees that that's what where it's going to play out, and
right,
he's placing
clearly,
her there, and
exactly.
She's being agreeing and submissive at the same time. I think she's being very mavater. I could only imagine it's a mavater situation.
Okay, that's a nice word, mavater.
But she, I think that she doesn't yet understand her place,
right?
Okay.
But he does.
What's telling you that he does? We said why maybe she's not. There's no indication that she is. What's indicating to you that he is in the shop?
Because he's the one saying.
What's
what
he saying? Well, find the pasuk.
What will be done to her?
Let's back ourselves up. Okay, Maya Yaseh, Ladad et Shlomester, Maya Yaseh Ba, is that what you're seeing?
The Yod Aleph, the 11.
Right, what did he do, Ladad, Shlomester, Maya Yaseh Ba? What did he do for that purpose? First half of the Pasuk. Uvechol yom vayom Mordechai mitalech lebnichatzer ben anashim. He is doing something, but we always have to root ourselves in the Pshat, because we can't make things up, right? But the Pshat does say that. It says, every day Mordechai would go walking by the Chatzar Beit HaNashim where she was and where all the women were, because he wanted to know what was going to happen with her.
That's what makes us know, because he's so committed to scanning where she's going to be to be able to catch what comes down through her. So it all the more so emphasizes how this is the center and the focus, and he wants to be present to respond to Hashem through her circumstances.
Okay.
So maybe he suspects that she's going to be the Kli, but he doesn't know yet. He's
okay.
Waiting to see what happens to her, to see if Hashem will put her in the position.
He has an intuition, at least, because he puts her in that.
Why?
He puts her in into motion.
Right.
Okay, so let's see this inside.
She's a secret agent.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, let's see this inside, because this is, Mefarshim agree with you, but how? In an interesting way. The Rishon LeZion, which I think I sent you, yes, it says Rishon LeZion on the top, one of the commentaries, on the Megillah, says something interesting, but he darshans it also, again, we're tying everything to the words of the Megillah, he darshans it to Mordechai's instructions to her. Lo higida Esther amma ve'et mulatata. She wasn't supposed to say her nation or her mulatata, her birth origins. Why does it need to say both?
Yeah, why?
Okay, so according to the Rishon LeZion, Mordechai had two kavanas, two motivations in mind in instructing. Again, Esther, this wasn't Esther's idea. This was Mordechai's idea. And we learn his kavanas because it uses both terms. How so? Okay? Molatata, says the Rishon LeZion. Can I copy it for you? Inside? No, we're late, so we're not going to get inside. Okay? He had two ideas and two goals. Okay? First of all, let's do Amma comes first. Okay? Amma, who is her nation? The Jewish nation. Why should she conceal a Jewish nation? Well, we just talked about this party where Ahasuerus was celebrating the downfall of the Jewish nation, trying to get them to sin, right? He didn't think so highly of the Jewish nation. And according to the Rishon LeZion, neither did, that wasn't the environment at the time. The Jewish nation was looked down upon. Just a few decades before, they were taken into galus. They were exiled from their land. They were the downtrodden, the low of society, right? And they went from one galus to another galus. So they were still the downtrodden of society. They weren't well integrated in a way that people viewed as equal to themselves.
Well, some of them were enslaved.
Okay, so the Rishon LeZion says, Amma, what would have happened if Ahasuerus had known that she was of the lowly Jewish nation? He might not choose her. That means he thought there's some hashgacha pratis going on here. Now, he didn't choose her yet. No, in the psukim, she's not queen yet. She was just given special treatment. But already special treatment by, hey, guy is making more haggot. His hashgacha pratis people is going to be like, that's interesting. Yeah. Why is that happening?
Maybe she wouldn't have gotten special treatment if it was known.
If it wasn't meant to be. So already, Mordechai.
It was known that she was.
If, exactly. In other words, he said, I see some hashgacha pratis going on at work here. Let's protect it. Let's make sure nothing happens to counter the hashgacha pratis that I'm seeing unfolding here. So we won't tell her, Amma. Okay.
Like, you went from hiding her, and then it suddenly went like this, and he's like, okay, this is God's plan, and he
so it's
like,
so interesting, right? Because what happens in life, right? Sometimes, in one moment, we choose one way, and we think this is the right way, and then Hashem says, no, life is going to happen this way. And then we have to go with the flow, and we don't say, okay, Hashem, if you say life should go this way, then let me function as best as possible in this way.
Suddenly he's, like, intuiting that she might be queen, like, and is, like, accepting that, and working with it, and, like,
right.
That's such an incredible...
Right. But at the same time, he's protecting the Hashgacha Pratis, he's still worried about her, and he's still curious about it, and Molatata is him, says the Rishon LeZion. He is her Molatata. She can't say... From the word nolad, to be born, her birth origins. Anyway, she was orphaned, so he was the household that she came from. No one could know that they were related. Because what was he doing? He was mitalech lifnei chatzar beit hanashim. He was hanging around spying. Right? That wouldn't work very well if they knew that he was married to her. They'd be like, get away from here. She's here for the king.
Right.
So he was trying to protect his own efforts and her.
Anyway, they were looking for virgins, so...
So the Gemara actually says...
Problem.
Interesting point. The Gemara says that Ahasuerus didn't mind either way. And Esther actually functioned miraculously either way for him, as an interesting side mace in this story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, really?
But still, that would be a reason.
Okay.
Because we do see that that's what Ahasuerus is. That's what the men sense were looking for.
Right.
It's
interesting point.
That's not where they're looking for the two loves.
Interesting point.
I'm sure it does. So, her origins had to be...
Kol na rabatula, yeah, pasuk gimel.
Which is kind of interesting.
They took her anyway.
Then Mordechai must have known. Must have been placing her in this secret agent status, because otherwise he could have let it be known that she was his wife and she wouldn't have been taken.
Interesting. So I'm going to point out...
Is it only virgin, or is it sometimes just being young adults?
Bitula?
Yeah.
So the question is here, do we have a farshim explaining pasuk? Right, I never thought about that before, honestly. Pasuk gimel, what am I farshim saying here? Are they being particular about it? At least the few farshim I have in front of me. I'm not seeing a farshim commenting on that word.
I'm sorry.
Or darshan, that word in particular. I'm only looking at limited,
what's
number of...
Zeo she
amar katub.
And, you know, a young girl,
interesting.
Who generally considered to be not married.
Interesting. At the moment, I'm not seeing it discussed in particular. Right, the only thing that I did see is in the Gemara that it says that if he was in the mood for one way or the other way, Esther seemed like both to him. So either way, something about her, they liked, regardless of whether she was going to be Mordechai's house or not.
Because that's part of her submissive and proactive nature.
Yeah, there you go. This way and this way.
Interesting. Again, I don't know how much it was from her side or if it was just a purely physical thing the Gemara is describing. Matthias wise, I'm not sure. But, okay.
What is this?
Oh, the Gra. I don't have the Gra. Let's see what you got. No, the Lord's going to go. It's below. Okay, the Gra says it. Okay, so the Gra does say, thank you, says specifically he was looking for Bitzulot. For some reason, they took Esther. Maybe they were already hiding that Mordechai was married to her.
Right. Okay.
And then he was like, oh, man, maybe I should pretend her. Either way, so
that
according
would
to...
show Mordechai's intent from a very early stage in this process, that he allows her to be taken.
Right. Interesting. So here's an interesting thing also. We mentioned Rabbi Weinbach, who has a book where he kind of takes his own explanation based on all the Chazals, and he examines this idea of, like, why did Mordechai say not to tell her origins? And he says a number of different things, and he says the opposite, actually. He says Mordechai was thinking, footnote this, so I don't know where he gets this from, if it's his own idea, but he says that if she comes to them and doesn't reveal her family origins, they're going to think she must come from a pretty bad family that she doesn't want to say. She must come from the low lives of the low lives. Get her out of here. We don't want her with the king. According to Rabbi Wanbach, Dafka Mordechai told her not to tell so that she wouldn't be taken by the king. Maybe Mordechai really had no idea about how Shmuel Pratt is going.
Now you're telling us.
I love these balancing, countering opinions.
You have to be able to hold
them. Yes.
Very true. Yeah.
Okay. Dafka, maybe Mordechai wasn't a Navi. He was in the great Talmud Chacham. Maybe he was on Hedron, whatever. He wasn't a Navi. Maybe he didn't know what Hashem had in store. Maybe he saw, he knew what Torah says. He knew what Torah says, she's not allowed to go to the king. And he was trying to protect what he believed Torah says. And he was trying to actively do things to prevent Ahasuerus from taking her and protect her.
Wow.
Here's the crazy thing. It doesn't matter.
Wow.
Whether he was right about what Hashem planned for him or he was wrong about what Hashem planned for him. Either way, he's still the tzaddik and the hero of the story. He protected her when he felt she should be protected. He followed her when he felt she should be followed. And he went with her Hashgacha Pratis as it played out. That's all he could do in life. Sometimes we think we know what Hashem is planning for us. We think we see signs. Oh, look, when we tell these stories to each other, especially nowadays, I feel like there's like a big movement of like seeing Hashgacha in our lives. I'm like, wow, and I do this myself. I'll admit, you've seen me do this before. I write it, right? Like, look at what Hashem did. This happened in my life. And then this thing, and look how it's turning out. We don't know what Hashem is sending us in our lives. Are you kidding? We have no idea. Maybe it looks like it does. Maybe we're right. Or maybe we're wrong. But what does Hashem expect of us? We have to be the steadfast in our Torah beliefs and do our efforts to protect it. And if things end up turning a different way, then we go with the flow and we receive what Hashem sends us. And then we switch gears and go with whatever is going on then. I think it's a major lesson for us. We get a little presumptuous in our understanding of what Hashgacha Pratis really means.
I think that's really true. And for me, it's always, there has to be so much care because we can go to the flip side, which is people start saying, this bad thing.
It's very dangerous. It's actually very dangerous. Like, this person's fault, it's a punishment, it's my fault.
And then it's on their doors, blah, blah, blah. That's why their bus went off the, ledge. So
it's very tricky.
You have to be really, really careful. That's why both sides, I think, because it's two sides of the same coin.
So, we have to be very, very careful. For ourselves, we can try to see patterns, what we think, as long as we have the proper humility to go along with it. Just one other opinion that Weinbach mentions is that we mentioned previously that he killed his one wife before. What's going to happen to Esther? He figured if he killed a wife before, plus she's the, discriminated nation, that doesn't put her in a very good position. That's even more of a reason to be concerned. Let's just avoid him knowing that she's discrimination, and maybe it'll make him less likely to, even if she would be chosen, to be harmed in the process. Okay. Rashi, by the way, mentions that he said not to tell because she actually was from a royal family. Her real origins before Mordechai was from the family of Shaul Melech. And
Rashi's in the camp that he was preventing it.
Right.
Wait, I didn't hear you what?
Rashi's that takes the stance that he was trying to
call together. Right. Together. Which is, that's
funny.
Yeah.
I just want to mention that. It's
thank you. Okay, so that's, I just find that very interesting kind of dichotomy, lesson on the Shmuel Pratis. We'll do one more. Points in the last couple minutes, okay? I want to backtrack a little bit. Our discussion went in this direction, so I went with it, but now we're going to go back a couple of
seconds. Thank you for being
placed. I love it. It's great. That's what wonderful dynamics of Shira are all about. Okay, I'm picking on Pasuk Tet, okay? He said, hey guy, rush things for her, right? Vayishaneha. And he switched her, Vet Narotel, Lito. Something was being switched here for good. Now, the Pasuk already said he rushed her makeup and everything, so what's Vayishaneha? The Gemara has a really interesting machlokas about this, actually.
Did he push her ahead in line, or no?
Well, the word v'yishaneha doesn't mean that.
Right, okay,
v'yishaneha means something changed, l'shanot. Okay, so we're on 13a3, that page, on the right side, towards the bottom of the Gemara part of it, where it quotes that pasuk, v'yishaneha ve'narotah. He changed her and her maids. So, what does this mean? Amorav, she'echila machal yehudi. He'echila, sorry, machal yehudi. Rav said, this means what he changed for her? He changed her diet. All the women in the Beit Nashim had to be fed, which I think is interesting. Ahasuerus really was passionate about this contest. He spent a lot of money, apparently, sustaining for all these women to eat three times a meal a day, whatever meals they ate. But he changed it for her and gave her kosher food. Shmuel Amar, but Shmuel said, She'echila lekadle dechazire. The opposite. He didn't feed her kosher food. Rather, chazer. He fed her fatty hog bacon.
No way.
Yum. That's what he changed. And to me, what has changed about this, maybe it was fattier, you know, to fatten her up. Maybe to him it was a good thing, but obviously to her it was a bad thing. Okay, Rav Yochanan Omar, something completely different. This is what we mentioned before, Zar'onim. He gave her seeds tea, which would be kind of like the kosher foods, but some people have a minhag to have legumes on Purim, or to give in shachmanos, because chickpeas are Zar'onim, those kinds of foods. They're not, you know, they're easy to be, it wasn't Israeli produce that needs German rights, it was kosher, it was easy for eat, and maybe that's why she was rakokas, because she was eating this diet, you know, that was not so great. Okay, so three different opinions about what was changed for her. Two seem more conducive to what she would have wanted. One was definitely not. Now, here's the fun part. Okay, the Megillat Sarim has a great analysis of this Gemara, and we'll end with this Megillat Sarim. I think I sent it to you. It says Megillat Sarim on it. Okay, first of all, he says what she also changed her maidservants, and he understands this to mean she got Jewish maidservants who were matzim for her. That was like a hashgacha pratis, that the ones that were chosen for were different, and they were also Jewish. And then he goes on, and I made a little arrow where I'm going to start from. He's going to explain this machloket that we just said. Sherav amar she'achila machal yehudi, right? Shmuel amar she'achila kadle lechazire. Rav Yochanan amar she'achila zeronim. Shehutz mua b'may plige. What's the disagreement here? Lefi hanamar lamala iti shapir shekol chad misaper godel hanesh lefi dato. He's saying the difference between these three opinions is that each one is interpreting the nes the way he understands it to be. There is some nes here. Some mishgachah pratis. He's rushing her case. Okay, why is he favoring her? What did he do that favored her? Different things. Rav Amar Shanes Hu Shayu Minagim Ima Bida Yehudit Bli She'elata. They gave her Torahic things without asking her. They didn't know that she was Jewish. They didn't know, and still they just worked out. They gave her the kosher meal. Okay. Vamidula Misharto Israelo, also Jewish servants. Kamosh Amidula Mishar Hatach Shu Daniel. Also Hatach mentions later on helped her. He was Daniel, says Chazal. Okay, one opinion is the hashgacha pratis was she got kosher food, even though they didn't know that she was Jewish. Vidat Shmuel, so that's understandable, clear from the Gemara already. What does Shmuel say? Kedat HaZohar. Apparently, Shmuel is of the mindset of what the Zohar also teaches us, which is get ready. Okay, hold on. Trasit Shekatav, maybe for this before, I don't know. Shekatav Shelo Ba Esther Lemishkav Achashverosh Klal. Esther was never with Achashverosh intimately. Rak Sheidit. Actually, there was a demoness, a demon who swapped places with Esther, magically, forgive the term, kabbalistically, with Esther, anytime Achashverosh wanted to be with her, and Achashverosh actually never touched Esther. Then Cain, what does this have to do with our Gemara and our Pasuk? Cain yesh lamar kamo sheshina ota lufnei Achashverosh, kamo Cain shina ota venna ota v'sha'a shina ota l'chilaisur. Just like she was switched with a demon when Achashverosh wanted to be with her, also when they gave her non-kosher food. She was switched with a demoness. She never had to eat the non-kosher food. Okay? This is his interpretation of Shmuel saying, what's the nace in the fact that they gave her non-kosher food? There's no nace in that. They would be serving non-kosher food in the palace. No. The nace was, they fed her non-kosher food, but she wasn't actually in that body. Like, she wasn't there. She didn't need it. Something miraculous happened, and she was spared from that anti-Torah experience. Okay, ready for the third one. Now, let's get down to the next part, so we're almost done with our time. Rav Yochanan, okay, third opinion. And this is my favorite one. The demoness is like wacky, right? What is Rav Yochanan's take? What does his opinion mean? She ba'atzma shinta hargala v'tiv'a v'lo achla rak zeronim. What was the mirror?
She was a vegan.
She was a vegan. First vegan. Okay.
Vegan or demon?
Okay.
I didn't get the whole Hebrew.
Rabbi Yochanan Shehi Ba'atzma Shinta Hergila V'Tivat. What was the nace? Again, Megillat said it. These are nisim that the Gemara is laying out for us, writing, spelling out for us. What was the nace that happened? Yeah. Not that they gave her kosher food. Not that she was a demon. She herself changed her habits and her nature. That was the nace.
Wait a minute. In order to what?
By changing her diet and only eating the seeds.
What do you think about that?
You mean she ate what was available to
that
her?
That was kosher.
She loved kosher.
But so she was willing to sustain on a sparse vegan nut-based diet. It's not even really a vegan, it's a nut-based diet order to keep Torah and be present in the situation.
She saw that Mesiras Nefesh. It wasn't an easy thing. It wasn't a natural thing.
Right.
Okay? We said she had Mesiras Nefesh. Maybe it came naturally for her Mesiras Nefesh. Of course I'm only going to eat seeds. No, it was a miracle that she was able to change her nature
like
and her
that.
Habits.
Like that, also.
As soon as she got to the palace, and then she wasn't able to eat that anymore. Because
I'm
it wasn't
seeing good. From what Yael's saying is that both Mordechai and Esther, in their own, in their own ways as things play out, model that quick shift into different modes quickly, that like changing their tachi almost instantly, somehow miraculously.
Where are you seeing with Mordechai?
Well, we were saying about him being able, with Esther being hidden and then putting him out, and at one point...
Going with the flow of the stuff of whatever is happening.
He
shifted gears to what was...
And for her, too.
Interesting.
Really modeling, what is my top key in the moment? And I wonder if she learned that from him in the sense that he was her Rebbe in many ways.
Interesting.
You know?
But it's also saying that it's a miracle to be able to do that. That is really hard.
Right.
That's what I think.
I love it.
That's
right. That's not right. That's why I said it.
That's my. Oh, thank you. That's so